on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness to be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Welcome to the Happiness Algorithm with myself, James Roast, the show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, joining me on today's show is a surgeon, one of the first surgeons in the United Kingdom to successfully complete both the Masters in Oncoplastic Breast Surgery and the prestigious UK National TIG Oncoplastic Fellowship. My guest specialises exclusively in breast surgery, covering aspects of breast care, including breast cancer, benign breast diseases, family history of breast cancer, risk-reduced in mastectomy, breast reconstruction, and implant-based breast surgery. His special interest is the therapeutic mammoplasty. His research interest is on using ultrasound during surgery to improve breast cancer outcomes and patient experience. Today we'll be talking all things surgery, his career, how he handles the pressure, and of course, all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what he does to make himself that little bit happier. Please welcome to the show Dr. Harun Thomas. How are you doing, Harun?
I'm good. Thank you very much, James. Excited to participate in this radio show.
Well, I too am excited to have you on the show. I know we've been discussing this and talking about it for some time. And it's a real pleasure to finally be sharing a microphone with you and to protect this time and find this time to have this conversation, because I know it will be an extremely interesting conversation for me and I'm sure for the listeners. So Harun, tell us a little bit about, obviously it was a very brief introduction I gave you there. Tell me a little bit more about you, what you do, and your journey into medicine.
Well, I'm currently working as a consultant surgeon, mainly at Southend Hospital in Essex, but also covering the MSC, what's called Mid Essex and South Essex patch. And my special interest, as you mentioned, is treating breast cancer, but also all aspects of breast diseases and breast symptoms. I've been a consultant for the last 5 years at Southend, but been in the UK for about 17, 18, 19 years now. Initial bit as a general surgeon. I was born and brought up in India, initial training in India, medical school in India, initial surgical training in India, and then came over to the UK. And that's my journey so far.
So why medicine?
Interesting question. I was, as a child, I was not passionate or, people say, oh, I wanted to do this all my life. I was not like that. I was just an ordinary student. But as time went on, I did well in school, got the grades, got the aptitude. And in India, it was quite a lot based on academics, whether you got into medicine or not. And I did well in academics. And I always was a person people, in person man, could interact well with people. And it sort of felt like a good career to fall into. Got the grades, and so I fell into medicine, I should say. So it was not a planned career move into medicine, but obviously it's a brilliant career, helping people, interacting, research, teaching. It's an absolutely brilliant career.
And I'm always interested in, areas of medicine, and yourself, you moved into breast care and cancer and family history as well. So obviously the field of medicine is very broad and wide. How does each and every surgeon consultant narrow down their area of interest? What was your journey? And as you say, it was quite an organic transition into medicine from a young boy, and then how have you ended up at this stage that you're at now?
Yes, that's very interesting, because medicine is so vast. You can have almost any kind of personality can fit into one or other aspect of medicine. From one end, you can have the really acute emergency medicine where you are at the knife edge throughout your working time. To at the other end, you can be in a lab with no person contact or patient contact. So it's a big spectrum in between. My journey, I mentioned, started as a general surgeon. So the first 15 years of my career and training was as a general surgeon. It started in India, where we had to manage everything surgical from head to foot. So that was very exciting. And then I came to UK because of the opportunities available. And in UK, again, the first 10, 12 years was focused as a general surgeon. But I found that you could provide better care for the patient, better quality when you specialize. And so as I was training in UK, I found that breast surgery provides a good mix of both the scientific rigor of medicine and the artistic aspect of surgery. Breast cancer research is one of the most researched area in medicine. There's so much activity going on, advancements in treatments always happening. So we always have to learn, read, and update ourselves. And that stimulates my intellect very much. But the other side is our aim of treating or operating on patients with breast cancer is to leave them with a result so that they can forget about their breast cancer journey when they come out on the other side, and they can live life normally. And for that, we need the artistic aspect of breast cancer, where to cut, how to shape the breast so that it leaves as natural a result as possible. And it combines quite a lot of plastic surgical skills, general surgical skills, research, and it's a good balance of these two. And that's what attracted me to breast surgery as such. All other aspects of medicine, teaching, research, team working, all that is applicable in breast surgery. So it fitted into my personality very well.
It's really lovely to hear a large contributing factor to it is that it's where it fits or how it fits your personality. And equally, a broad smile to my face was the fact that you refer to it as both the balance between science and art. And interestingly, a psychiatrist I worked with many years ago would often use the same phrase, that although medicine is very much in the heart of science, at times it favors more of an artistic touch than the black and white nature of science, as it were. So it's great to see and wonderful to hear that you adopt a similar principle, that you see that there is this importance to both the scientific and the artistic side to it.
Nice to hear that, yes. Absolutely. I think that's true of many branches of medicine.
Yes, yes. Now, where do I start with this? Where do I start? You mentioned also the importance of the personal aspects of the journey. So, you said that you've always enjoyed the interaction with people and talking and helping others as well. Now, the discipline that you chose obviously must be quite difficult at times. There obviously are some triumphs and some good news stories. There must be some quite difficult stories as well. If we may, let's start with what is it that you enjoy about the work that you do?
Well, the interaction with the people, and that's the main aspect. Not just patients, colleagues, and team members. So one big aspect of work is dealing with the patients who come fearing that they've got breast cancer and able to reassure them that they are fine. And probably 9 out of 10 people we see in our clinics don't have breast cancer. And so checking them up, making sure they're fine, explaining why they're getting their symptoms and reassuring them. And that brings a lot of satisfaction. 1 in 10 who I see in clinic, or probably even less than 1 in 10, might have breast cancer. And holding their hand through their journey of, say, a year or less, as they go through the treatment, and telling them that most of the time, they have a very good outcome. We see both ends of the spectrum, people who come in with a diagnosis, and the most people who go out on the other side having successfully completed treatment and going on to live a normal life. And holding someone's hand through that process and reassuring them that most of the time on the other side, there is a positive outcome, that is very rewarding. Now, not always it goes well. There are often setbacks, complications, unexpectations, but we've seen all this. And to the patients, these are big things, but this is things we have seen before, and reassuring them and saying this will happen, this can be dealt with, and this is how we're going to manage that. So that is highly satisfying when someone trusts their life and their emotional well-being onto your hands, and you trust to take them through that journey. That is an amazing experience. Now, on the other side is interacting with colleagues and other team members. Now, I think that is more challenging because of all the personalities that we interact with. Like any job anywhere, medicine is filled with personalities and team working. And navigating that is very interesting and often more challenging than actually treating breast cancer. So yes, it is a very exciting field.
So now I'm intrigued to understand more about how you manage those dynamics of the sort of professional relationships that we are all faced with, relationship at the very heart of our existence as well. And in such a, at times, pressurized environment, as you touched on there, the joys that come with the work, but the challenges that you face through the presenting illness. But how do you particularly manage those difficult dynamics?
So as doctors, we have two main groups of skills. One group of skill is to deal with the disease. So that in my case, it is dealing with all things related to breast diseases. But there's another big group of skills that we learn, which is called non-technical skills, which is on communication, leadership, team working, dealing with stress. And this is not, it was not stressed in the earlier years. When I was trained, no one taught me how to deal with these things. But nowadays, it is given much more emphasis. And you did mention I've done a master's in oncoplastic breast surgery, which is a 3-year master's program. And 4 months of that program was on leadership and management and team working. And after finishing that program, I joined as a faculty in that master's program. And I now lead that four-month module on leadership and management. And that is my teaching role, essentially. And in that period, what we try and teach doctors is how to assess your own personality, what are your strengths and weaknesses, how do you assess the personality of others you work with, and how can you bring out the strengths in the others, and how do you adapt to other personalities. Everyone is different, so you can never expect everyone to work as you want to. There's so much on communication. How do you communicate well, make sure everyone understands what the aim is? How do you work as a team? Medicine is a team goal. And when I treat someone with breast cancer, I'm working with probably four or five other consultants of other specialties, breast care nurses, other admin and nursing support. So there's a big team involved. And then there's a management team who provide the resources. So how do you interact with all of them? How do you do it in a safe way? How do you risk assess? How do you manage risk? How do you deal with complications? So there's so much other than the technical aspect of dealing with medicine, dealing with diseases that we are trained to now. And I'm trying to teach others, and I'm trying to apply those things on a day-to-day basis.
That's fantastic to hear that there is this focus and emphasis given to the importance of communication, managing stress as well. And how lovely to see that you're part of that teaching faculty now as well, and imparting your wisdom and knowledge and sharing your experiences with those surgeons and doctors going through that training. Now, you said in your early training the non-technical skills side of medicine, that it wasn't really there was that deficit there around dealing with stress and difficult situations. Why do you think that there's been a shift from when you started in medicine to where we are now and actually what you're providing?
I think there's a greater awareness that the outcomes from managing diseases is not just based on the technical skills of the doctor. It is also significantly dependent on how the doctor works with others, because it's a team game, and what the emotional and mental state of the doctor is. Because if I go in to do an operation stressed and not in a good emotional state, I'm likely to do worse than if I'm calm and controlled and composed. And so that's true with every doctor. So the outcome, our essentially our aim is to give the best outcome for the patients. And that is not just depending on your medical skills. It's on, and there's a big realization now that this is a team game, and all the non-technical skills are as important as the technical skills. And that realization has made many of the curriculum developers, universities, to concentrate a lot on providing the doctors with the non-technical skills. And that emphasis has built. And so that's why in our master's program, we have a 4 months module specifically to this, this aspect of medicine. And it's the same in many of the curriculum developed around the world now.
Do you ever see students of the master's program struggle with that side of the curriculum? Do you ever see, because in my mind, I suppose that it's shifting it and working more in those shades of grey. Obviously, as we said before, medicine, the science of what it is, I'm making quite a broad and blank statement here, but it's quite black and white, if you will. But when we're looking at the non-technical skills aspects, the opportunity to manage dynamics in difficult situations, communication, empathy, relationship, obviously these are more shades of grey that we're working in. Do you ever see individuals really struggle to grasp that part? The reason I ask that, sorry, I'm just going to add a caveat to it, to this question, is the reason I ask that is because when we look at the world of psychology and emotions, they're very much in those shades of grey as opposed to the black and white. And, you know, certainly for myself and working with individuals, people do tend to struggle and we crave that certainty in black and white. Just curious to understand whether there are certain individuals that come through medicine that when we're starting to work in that non-dichotomous way, do struggle a little, or maybe not.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Doctors are human beings, and like any team, any group of people, you will have a wide spectrum of people in that. Some naturally develop these skills. Some have these innately before they join medicine. Some need support to develop these, which is doable. The more difficult is the doctors who don't think it's important. And that is the biggest struggle. If there's someone who doesn't have the insight to understand that these skills are equally important, they wouldn't be interested in developing these. And that is more challenging than someone who sort of struggle to get these skills, because these are learnable skills. But if they don't have that insight, it is much more difficult. But of course, it is now much more mandatory to develop these during the curriculum.
That resistance that you may sometimes come up against, you know, those individuals that, you know, we're looking to create that paradigm shift for those to see that these skills and these assets are of equal importance. How would you approach something like that, Haran?
Mainly through examples. So most of the complications, most of the bad outcomes in medicine is often because of poor non-technical skills, lack of communication, lack of teamwork, rather than someone deliberately going and doing something wrong to a patient. And so once we show others that these are the reasons why things go wrong, it is not often because someone does an operation wrong. Then they understand. For example, you often hear of people operating on the wrong side of the body, wrong arm or something. These are big, like serious incidents, never events kind of thing. And if you, no one goes in and deliberately does that. It's because of a series of poor communication, lack of checking, and so there's many reasons why it happens. But just one example. And once you show the doctors that the mistakes happen because of all these non-technical skills, they often understand and appreciate it.
So we've touched on the positives that your role brings, what you enjoy, the development of self, constant evolution of knowledge and people, you know, has been laced through the first part of this conversation, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about earlier, if I may. Now, obviously, as we said, that there is the area that you work, there must be great tragedy and difficult times as well. How do you manage that?
Very interesting question. So that's managing stress, for ourselves and for our patients. And this is, again, something I teach and try and train others in our leadership and management. So essentially stress in our career, not just in medicine, in life or in any career, can be two ways. One is a predictable stress. So you know you're going to be stressed in the morning when things are going to be busy and, you know, you need to get everything done and you need to get to work. You know that's going to be a stressful time. Similarly, in medicine, we know there can be stressful times. I know some operations are going to be very difficult. Chance of complications are more. So when it's predictable, I deal with stress by doing things to, as much as possible, minimize it. So, for example, if I am planning for a difficult operation, and I know these are things that can go wrong. One, I make sure I'm mentally prepared on that day. Two, I go through the steps again and again They say, these are the possibilities. If this happens, I know this is what I need to do. So it's not unexpected. Three, I know I've got help around. So if I know it is a difficult operation and it may, something might happen, which is beyond my technical skills, I make sure there's someone else who has the technical skills to come and help me. So it's always teamwork. So making sure there are others around who can help you. Talk to others early. And that often helps. There might be others who have dealt with the similar situations before who will just say, oh, I've done this before. I'll come and stay with you. And I've that happens with trainees. I often go and just say, you crack on, I'm here. It's stressful for them, but I've done them many times. So it is planning ahead often helps deal with stress. A second situation is actually dealing with the stress when it happens. Now, this is more difficult, especially if it is an unexpected stress. First thing is not to panic. There's no stress which probably immediately causes a catastrophic event. And especially as surgeons, we know the patients don't just die like that. A bleeding happens, it can be controlled. So take a deep breath, pause, and take a few seconds. And then reassess the situation, call for help, and take it step by step. And then a very important thing is, after dealing with the stress, a debrief and getting your emotional state back in track. So this is how I deal with stress in a three-phase approach. One before, second during the stressful, and third after the stressful event.
That is that is fascinating. You mentioned something there, which again sort of pricked my attention, and you said, you make sure that you're mentally prepared. Would you tell me a little bit more about that and what that means to you?
Yes, so that takes me into what's called the mental well-being and the emotional well-being situation, which is probably something which is most difficult to control and plan ahead and to realize when you are emotionally stressed and worried, and you can't work to your good maximum capacity. And it generally are areas where you feel uncomfortable emotionally, a bit stressed, not just right. And those are the times when I try and probably take a minute break. What I often do is a minute of breathing exercise, and it different skills and different ways to do this, but some call it a meditation, some call it sort of aspects of mindfulness, but what I do is a minute of away from what I'm doing and forgetting everything, concentrating on breathing and doing a bit of breathing exercises, and that helps calm myself down. So whenever I feel stressed or emotionally a bit stressed, that's what I do to try and bring back. Now, if that doesn't help, then I wouldn't do anything very important at that time, because doing important things when you're emotionally stressed is not a good idea. So I just, if I can postpone something, I would do that or ask someone to help out in that situation. But that's how I deal with emotional stress in the acute state. Of course, there are probably worries in life we all have, and the best way is to talk it through with someone, family, friends, and often a problem shared is a problem solved and halved. So that helps quite a lot, getting the emotional balance back.
Breathing exercises, yes. Is this, obviously, we can know and advocate the benefits of such sort of exercises, as you say, in acute periods of stress, and quite rightly, no good decision was ever made in a time of crisis or under such stress. Is this something, there's two parts to this question, is this something that you encourage students on the master's program to explore and undertake? Question one. Question two being, when did you start bringing this into your practice? Is this been something that you have done for many a year, or is it more recent?
No, it's not. Well, let's ask one by one. So the first question is it something that the master's students learn? They are made aware of this, of the techniques available. Obviously, the program is quite a small program, and breathing, mindfulness, meditation is by itself a whole practice and training required. So we don't have time for them to practice it during the course, but they are made aware that resources are available to develop mindfulness and meditation, which they can explore. And the feedback has been enormous, because many doctors don't know that these techniques are available. And sometimes the feedback is, this techniques is the most useful part of the module, because we didn't know this exists, we were stressed often, and this helps us a lot. So that's the answer to the first question. The second aspect, when did I learn these skills? Not long ago, actually. I mentioned my first part of career was as a general surgeon, and the focus of all that was to become a consultant in the NHS. And so I achieved that in 2015, and I settled down into the job. And I thought it would be like a happily ever after life. But I realized it's not. Desires grow, your ambitions grow, and you're not significantly happier than before. And that's when I explored aspects of well-being. And one aspect of well-being is mindfulness and emotional well-being. And so I read more about mindfulness and meditation, and practiced some of these techniques through online books and apps. And that is what, that's how. So it's all in the last 2 years that I've started developing the breathing techniques and mindfulness aspects.
Well, that is wonderful to hear that you've begun to adopt these principles of managing well-being, because our physical health our emotional health, should I say, is just as important as our physical health as well. And it's lovely to hear yourself sort of recognize that and the equality that sits alongside those. Now, without further ado, we must move to your first song choice, because when we come back, I do want to take a deeper dive into well-being and explore that in much greater depth as we've moved on to there. And I've got some wonderful questions that I want to sort of fire your way, as it were. So stick with us here on the Happiness Algorithm. My name is James Roast, as you know, and I'm joined by the fantastic Dr. Harun. Now, he has chosen, I'll let you hear his first song choices and we will talk about them after. Stay with us. We'll be back after this.
There was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do ya? When it goes like this, the fourth and fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composed. Kitchen chair, she broke your throne and she cut your hair.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. My special guest today is Dr. Haroon Thomas, and that was his first song choice. That was Alexandra Burke, Hallelujah. Lovely song there, Haroon.
Thank you. Yes, it is X Factor 2008, so it is a very fascinating song.
It is. Music, just quickly, is it important to you? Are you a lover of music? Do you listen to much music?
Not much, to be true. It is mostly spiritual songs than music. So it's not something I grew up with. It's not something we had in our family. So naturally, I'm not into music significantly, but I do listen to. No, most of the songs that I listen to are hymns on a spiritual basis.
Ah, and this is something that we will come on to speak a little bit more later in the show, sort of spirituality and faith, etc. I was going to ask, am I right in thinking that some surgeons like to have music playing in the theatre sometimes as well, in the operating theatre, whilst they're working?
Yes, absolutely. It is quite a few surgeons put on music and that is sort of, it relaxes the atmosphere. It's a very common practice, and I don't object to it as long as no one sings by themselves. So it's fine. Yes.
Excellent. So before that break, we were moving towards sort of emotional well-being, managing stress. We touched on breathing exercises there as well. But before we dive a little bit deeper, one question that came to mind based on your role, what you do, your journey over the last, nigh on 20 years, starting in medicine in India and over to the UK now as well. Obviously, there are the highs that we touched upon, and there are some very difficult, tragic circumstances and cases that you have dealt with as well. The question that's left rattling around is, your perception of life and death and the relationship you have with both, has it changed at all? From the young boy growing up in India to, where you are now, you see life and death in a much more explicit way than most people do. And has it changed your relationship and your thoughts and feelings around it?
Well, absolutely. It life is a journey, and our thoughts and emotions change, and I'm no different. Over the last few years, I've taken a lot of interest into life and well-being and death. And of course, we see death occasionally, because breast cancer has a mortality associated with it, and it is devastating when the small or minority of patients don't do well. And so we do deal with death, and it has made me think both as life of why we are not living and what is the purpose. So that's the spiritual basis of it, but also of death. We see death in all age groups. I've seen young ladies in their 30s who succumb to breast cancer and die, and that is absolutely tragic. But it just shows that we don't have absolute control of these things. We do our best, but often there are circumstances beyond our control, and that is a difficult situation, but it is part of our career and our life. But it does open to our own mind about thoughts about mortality and more important, to live life to the fullest, essentially.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that, that it's such a, I always feel that, the challenge with life is life itself. And I remember speaking at a conference once with an individual who was quite high up in hospice care in the UK. And and she was speaking with regards to, it was a conference on services and access to services, and she was speaking about her residents, or, you know, the residents, those that are in hospices that are terminally ill, and she felt that actually there was a lack of provision for those that were in that that difficult situation, and a lot of the time services wouldn't provide any form of help because there was this assumption that, well, you know, they were in their difficult situation, there was no point reaching out, as it were. And she said that, you know, look, there is no such thing as the only terminal illness that we're faced with is life itself, because we will all sort of follow the same path, in the sense that we're all between that life and death corridor, as it were. So, and it was a very interesting take, and made me think a lot about where that sits and what we're all faced with. And as I say, hence why the question I wanted to ask, is, you know, someone that is faced with death more frequently than most, does it find a different space in your well-being? So we did talk on well-being there just before the break, and I'd like to sort of understand a little bit more about your journey, Haran, and your relationship with well-being, and how that has organically changed over the years.
Yes, so I started exploring well-being probably 2 or 3 years ago. And as I mentioned before, initial focus of my career life was to settle down as a consultant. And it is a tough journey, very competitive, tough training as expected. And I've done all the masters and programs and got this consultant job. And the first 2 years was settling down as a consultant with a new consultant. So that all went very well. And I thought, oh, now it's all settled. I've got what I wanted when I started off. And it should be life happily ever after this. But then I realized, no, not really. This is my new normal. And I'm starting looking at, oh, what's next? How can I improve? Is there something more to attain? And I found that very strange, because it is not, I mean, if I've got what I wanted 10 years ago, I wanted this, and if I got it and I'm not happy, I won't be happy 10 years down the line if I aim for something else and achieve it. And that was a important realization in my life. And so I explored why this is, why I'm getting such thoughts, and why am I not, I'm not saying I'm depressed or mentally affected, but just not satisfied. And I read around this, and that's how I got into the well-being concept. And there are obviously different aspects of well-being. Well-being is essentially being happy, comfortable, and satisfied in your state. And there are different aspects to well-being. There is the physical well-being, there is the financial well-being, there's the emotional well-being, there's the spiritual well-being, there's aspects of family, friends, community. So there are different aspects of well-being. We can explore each one if you want to. But what I found was, or reading through, what I found was this aspects of humans of never being satisfied with what you have. And when you get something, you'll be all right for some time, but then you will want to desire something more. And that process seems to just go on till you're never really happy. And what I've realized is, more important than trying to get something more to make you happy is to appreciate what you have now and be happy with what you have now. It is a thread which goes through all religions. For the atheists, it is the practice of mindfulness. And essentially, it is enjoying life as it is. Because in the UK, we've got things which most of the world cannot dream of. And if you're still not happy and trying to achieve more, I'm not saying it's wrong to achieve more. It is very important to try and achieve more. But to think that will make you happy is wrong. So be happy with what you have, but at the same time, aim for higher. And that is my current situation. And been exploring all aspects of well-being over the last 2 years, as I mentioned, the different facets of well-being.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And so there's a sense of, well, it goes back to, you know, you touched on it there and we said before the break that, you know, becoming a consultant was the aim and the belief that that would then bring with it happiness as a as an umbrella term. But yet when you achieved that, there was this realization that there must be more. And I suppose what's pleasing to hear is that you didn't fall into that trap of redirecting that focus towards another goal. And, you know, I see it frequently in clinic and individuals and not the whole society, but large percentage of society. And I think that we're nurtured and almost conditioned and encouraged to fall into this goal orientated system that when we get there, then we're happy. When we achieve this, then it's, and as you quite rightly say, it's momentary. It does bring joy and happiness to achieve a goal, but it isn't the only singular contributing factor to what defines happiness. That realization, Haran, when you got to that, how did you feel when it didn't deliver the sense, the complete sense of satisfaction or happiness that you was hoping it would do? What was the emotions that went with that realization?
Well, probably you can call it what's called the midlife crisis. I don't know. Is that midlife crisis? Then that is it. you achieve.
We can call it that. Yep.
Yeah. It achieve. You know what? Normally, someone who starts career aims for a stable job. You know, a stable life, and then suddenly realizing there's more to it. And it was eye-opening for me. I mean, I didn't realize there was this well-being aspect to life. And it made me explore so many other aspects of well-being, the financial well-being, the physical well-being, the spiritual well-being, the emotional well-being. And I've been reading around all this for the last two years. And it has opened out another facet of life, which I would have just missed if I just, you know, gone along with the life as I used to do before.
What made you move in the direction of exploration? What is it that about you, Haran, that that moved you towards exploring and looking to discover the why behind this current emotional position? And others perhaps go out and buy a convertible car in that midlife crisis. So what made you go out and explore and reflect upon your own sense of self as opposed to crash and really struggle with those emotions?
I think one is that I achieved what I wanted to, which is a high goal, getting trained as a consultant and being a consultant and achieving that and then realizing that is not making me completely satisfied. So that realization made me go out and explore these. And if that can't make me completely happy, another convertible or another physical thing in life is not going to make me any happier. So that it's that realization which made me explore it. But also there's something called financial well-being. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but a year or two ago, there was a situation where doctors, if they work more than a certain hours, would actually lose their pay. Well, reduce, not lose their pay, will actually earn less. And that's because of these complex tax rules and things like that. And that made me realize that it's not just going on working and working and working. There's more to it. And I read around financial well-being, and that's how it sort of, so these two sort of came at the same time. One, realization that being a consultant hasn't made me completely happy, and two, this aspect of financial well-being. It's not money that's going to make me happy. And I read around that aspect quite a bit, which is also fascinating. These two came out at the same time, And these two triggers made me explore this well-being concept.
And it's great to hear that that there is that breadth of reading around the different components of well-being, because I, like you, agree that, you know, quite often it's lumped together, but we can distill it down into individual areas. There's a wonderful therapeutic approach called acceptance and commitment therapy that focuses in on spirituality, financial well-being, career, family, relationships, security. So and enables us to recognize that, you know, there are contributing parts to our well-being, and if one is in a position of fragility or vulnerability, in as opposed to feeling overwhelmed, instead of feeling overwhelmed by a current situation, we can apply or focus an element of attention in that area to achieve balance and equilibrium. So it's great that you were reading around these different parts of self that make up our global well-being. Now, you said about appreciating the now. How do you achieve this? How could we achieve this? How could others listening to this now, you know, how do they find that grounding experience, that centering, and being appreciative of the here and now and this moment?
So of all the concepts of well-being, physical, financial, social, family, spiritual, this is what I found most difficult, the emotional, mental well-being. Because mind is such a wild beast. You know, if you think of mind as a part of your body, like your arm or leg, you wouldn't let your arm or leg do things by itself without any control. But if you sit there for a minute, your mind just wanders off. I could be sitting still for a minute, and then I might be the best soccer player, I might be the best cricket player, I might be the president of America, I could be anything. And the mind is such a wild beast, which just flies away. And this concept of, can you control your mind? I still can't. It is the most difficult. And probably that is the skill. I'm no expert in this, and there are lot of books I'm still working on and reading on these things. But what I think that the way to control the mind is meditation and breathing exercises. But mindfulness is more about, rather than just, you know, living in the past and the future, which is what mind normally does, try and live in the moment. Appreciate what we have. And in the UK, I mean, we've got, almost everyone has got shelter, food, clothes, compared to the rest of the world, we are blessed abundantly. Even if we are not, look around and look at the beauty of nature. Nothing is created by us. There's the sky, the mountains, the water, the rain, the rivers, the sea. It's such flowers. It's just beautiful all around. And can we appreciate each of these aspects? If not beauty, can we appreciate what we have in our life and enjoy it on a moment-to-moment basis? Simple things like the beauty of a flower, a bee flying around, the rivers or the rain falling, the sounds, the smells. Appreciate what you have. And if you're struggling, rather than look up to what others have more, look around to see what others don't have. If you look around the world, you will find that probably 9 out of 10 people have less than what we have. It just helps us appreciate what we have got. And if we appreciate that in this moment, and if you're still struggling, realize we could lose any of these skills anytime. So these are all skills I use to live in the moment. So if I realize, oh, I could lose my health, I could lose my money, I could have a serious illness, I could die any time. That realization by itself helps me appreciate what life has to offer at the moment. And that's, these are all skills I use to live in the moment.
Wow. I mean, I'm feeling more relaxed just listening to you, Haran. I mean, these are such simple gestures that we can make to self that are so easily overlooked and underutilized. Just that, for me, the headline statement there is that the realization opens up appreciation. The opportunity to, as you quite rightly say, you know, follow the flight of a bee, or, you know, to focus in on a flower, appreciate our surroundings, lifts us from a particular period of crisis or demand or increased stress that, you know, any of us can be consumed by in a ever-changing external landscape, in a world that's constantly demanding of us. And as you quite rightly point out, and just to sort of validate or echo that point, is the fact that our brain is a, well, I'm going to use your word, is a wild beast, and it's difficult to tame, and it does want to move forward, and it does want to delve into the past, and that constant movement back and forward can pull us in all sorts of directions. And the effort that we, and the application that we make to bringing it back to center, you know, to appreciate wherever we are in the world, the mountains, a stream, running water, being present, the flower, the bee, can open up that realization and enable us to appreciate what we have. And it's not determined by the figure in the bank account, or, you know, appreciate that we are here, we are now, we are drawing breath into our lungs, and we are living. And I think it's very hard for many sometimes to reach that stage. And as you say, 2 or 3 years you've been investing in time and patience and practice into trying to manage the beast that the mind is, and it's an ongoing process, I can imagine.
Absolutely, can't agree more.
Now, we have touched upon very lightly spirituality, faith, and the importance of that. Haran, would you tell me a little bit more about where that sits with you?
Yes. So again, one thing I've been thinking a lot. You mentioned about mortality and how we deal with this and all that. And one thing I've been thinking a lot is we all die, but there's big questions of life. I realize that physical things and money is not going to make me happy. And so then comes the big questions of life, of, you know, where have we come from? Why are we in this world? Where are we going? These big questions, I think we all have to answer that, because if we don't find our own answers to it, we will not have a spiritual well-being. Each person answers it differently. My upbringing and my faith is based on the Christian faith. And to me, the Christian faith gives me answers to these questions. And it gives me enormous well-being, because it gives me a grounding and an answer to these three questions. And so I'm no longer worried about death. And that is so powerful to me, because if I am going to be worrying about death all the time, I can't live. And the faith, the Christian faith that I've got, has given me that assurance and that well-being. I don't expect everyone to agree to my belief, but I hope everyone can answer these questions in their own ways, because otherwise the worry of death will always hang over your head and you can't leave. So that's where spiritual well-being comes in to me, the faith of why I am here and what happens after death.
Well, those are some some big questions, and I'm sure many would feel phased by those. But I have to agree that I think they are fundamental questions to our existence. So, you know, why we're living, why we are here. And, well, I suppose the word that jumps out is the why element. You know, easily there's some wonderful stuff, theory called the golden circle, that speaks about the what's and the how's. And many people get caught up in the what's and the how's. If we go back to something we spoke of earlier, you know, becoming a consultant, what do I need to do? How do I need to achieve it? But unless we ask that why question, we'll never really connect with the true value of our existence. And it's interesting because I speak with many adolescents that are often explicitly faced with that sense of mortality, that question of, you know, look, we know the adolescent period is a moratorium of chaos, and, you know, all bets are off and rules are suspended. It is, it's a bonkers period for any of us, because it's that transition of relevant dependency from moving through childhood into adulthood, and so it becomes a very, very dynamic and volatile period as one develops that sense of identity and that sense of self. So I tend to see a lot of adolescents asking these big, juicy, meaty questions of why we are here, and why we are living, why we are existing, and obviously that plays out in various forms. It is such an interesting conversation, and one that I think that you're quite right to put forward, that we should all be asking this of ourselves, because otherwise we can wake up at a certain point in our life and feel very disappointed and again overwhelmed of perhaps, oh, we've not achieved this goal, or we've achieved all these goals, and what now? Where do I go from now? What is this? But for you, as you quite rightly say, faith has played an important part in that. And your spirituality, and that's provided the assurances that you've needed.
That's right, absolutely.
Well, I think we should go into your second song choice, and I'm going to throw it over to you, Harun, to introduce this song, because I think it's quite an apt time for us to play your second and final song choice. So over to you, Harun. Tell us about this song and introduce it for us.
Thanks, James. So this song sits very much into my spiritual well-being concept. And the spiritual well-being concept that I have got is that God has created everything that we see around us. And we are here to enjoy that, but at the same time, thank God for creating this. And this song thanks God for what we see around us, the 10,000 reasons that we can find, and many more. And also it touches upon what will happen at the end of our life, that it's not an end, but there is something beyond which goes on for infinity. There's something to look forward to. And so this song glorifies and thanks the Creator, and also gives me hope to look forward to something after death. And it's one of my favorite hymns. It's 10,000 Reasons by Matt Redman.
Bless the Lord, oh my soul, oh my soul. Worship His holy name. Sing like never before, oh my soul. I worship Your holy name. The sun comes up, it's a new day dawning. It's time to sing Your song again. Whatever may pass and whatever lies before me,
chance for my heart to find. So bless the Lord, my soul. Oh, my soul. Worship His holy. Time has come, still my soul will sing your praise unending. 10,000 years and then forevermore, forevermore. Bless the
Phoenix FM.
Well, there we go. Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. And my very special guest today is Dr. Haran Thomas. And that was his second song choice. That was, and well linked in by my guest, that was 10,000 Reasons by Matt Redman. A lovely song there, Haran.
Thank you. Yes, it fits in very well to the spiritual well-being concept.
It certainly does. It certainly does. Well, sadly, we are into the final part of the show. It always flies by. I've got to say, I've really, really enjoyed our conversation today, Haran. But we'll carry on. We will push ahead with what we were discussing before, and look more at, you know, those well-being concepts, and again, drill down into what others can do to manage their well-being, and perhaps begin to sort of just tweak up that happiness dial a little bit more. So what are some of the things, well, more of some of the things that you've already discussed about what you've learned on your journey from young Haran, little Haran back in India there as a child, all the way through your adolescent and adult and professional life as well? What else have you learned on your journey?
I think the most important was this realization that physical things are not going to make me happy. It is the experiences that we have during life that are most important. Or to put it other way, it is not the destination, it is the journey that is most important. Enjoy the journey, each step of the way. Practical tips you mentioned, and now we could go on for hours on these things, but can I encourage the listeners to Google well-being circle or well-being concepts, the different aspects of it. Now, each of these we can speak for hours on. There's the physical well-being on exercise, diet, sleep aspect. There's the financial well-being, which I'm quite interested in, because I think money worry is a big, big worry for people. And it's not often because of lack of money. It's because people don't know how to deal with money. And that's where financial well-being comes into. And something fascinating, which I am now exploring much more on a more official basis, identifying goals and trying to, you know, get to those goals kinds of things. Spiritual well-being, I would encourage everyone to ask those big questions of life and try to find their own answers. I have got my my answers from the Christian faith. Everyone is different. Career, you know, we spend a significant amount of our lives in our jobs, and making that a happy place will help our well-being enormously. So again, not enough time to go into that, but you can explore on many aspects. And of course, last but most important, family, friends, and community. If you have a happy family, you are likely to be a happy person, because it helps all other dimensions. So work on you know, your family, stable relationships, and community. There's so many aspects everyone can work on, but explore the well-being circle. And that would be, I think, my top tip.
Frantically trying to capture everything you're saying to make these notes as robust as they should be and deserve to be. So we have, you know, I've got to be honest, Aaron, there is so much to take from today's show, and just for the listeners to sort of to reflect some of the stuff that I'll be looking at, and what I'm really pleased to begin to embody is enjoying the journey and not the end goal, as you said before, and exploring the importance of communication, family, friends, that community, that well-being circle as well. Googling and the search engines for the different concepts of well-being, and the different facets that it represents. Asking ourselves the big questions in relation to sort of spirituality and our presence, the here and now of who we are, you know, our just the very essence of our existence, and finding peace in the simplicity or the enormity, whatever way we want to level that up, at, you know, the mountains or the bee or the flower, and recognizing that the world, sorry, I beg your pardon, that the mind is a beast. That is difficult to tame, but we mustn't be frightened of that. It is about that attention and the time that we give to it. And seeing that money isn't the be-all and end-all, that we shouldn't be focusing in on a figure as a goal-orientated approach, and we have to find a relationship and understand how we use money to ascertain or to contribute to our sort of happiness, as it were.
Summarized it very well, James. Well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. If you could see my my show notes, there are scribbles everywhere. There was something that we touched on earlier in the show as well, but I apologize for I'm not picking up. But you mentioned the phrase predictable stress, and you said it's about, you know, often we're faced with a busy day or, you know, a clinic ahead. A little bit more about then the unpredictable stresses of life and how we would manage those in the same way that you've outlined there, that we've touched upon.
More difficult, because it is called unpredictable stress because we can't plan for it. So it can come on at any time. So classical example for us is you're doing an operation and an unexpected event happens. Everyone's life will have different scenarios where that happens. One thing we could do is try to minimize the chance of it happening. So, for example, you are going for a journey, prepare well, not get out in time. It's unlikely that unpredictable events will happen. Lots of, you know, planning ahead and, you know, checklists and doing things early and planning for things, this will reduce the chance of unpredictable stresses happening. When it happens, how I deal with this, the breathing exercise. Take a minute off that, take a few deep breaths. Most of these stresses can wait for a few minutes. Take those few minutes. And that often calms the mind down, and a calm mind can deal with these stresses better. But probably most important is to reflect on these after the stressful event and think of why it happened and how we can avoid it happening again. If it was an argument with someone, why did it happen? It's not healthy for both parties. Is there something that can be done? Is there some contributory factor? Work on it. And I think a debrief and wind down is extremely important after this.
Yeah, so almost a two-phase principle. And I think it's often lost for many that they deal with the crisis in the moment, that unpredictable stress that presents. But I think a key point there, as you raise, is the reflection process, the debrief process thereafter. Because through that, we then gives or provides us an opportunity to learn and grow even further. So we've managed through the acute crisis or stress, through breathing exercises, a very responsive gesture as opposed to being too reactive. But then that reflective process enables us to understand and, you know, perhaps look at preventing or decreasing the unpredictability aspects of life. But even if not, even if there is nothing that we could have anticipated or done differently, at least there's the acknowledgement and we're offering that kind of voice to ourselves through that debrief period. Now, there was another question, one final question before we sort of move on to the final part is, now, obviously, you, Haran, we've said that the individuals, the patients that you're working with, go through the basic primary base elements of our existence. It is distilled down through the diseases that they face. It's distilled down to the black and white principle of life or death. And I often wonder whether individuals that have come that close or have experienced a period of time of that dichotomous state, whether some of these principles around being present and appreciation of one's existence are easier to come by if we have gone through this difficult experience. Now, again, I'm going to add something in to not make this question overly challenging, but this is not me suggesting that anyone should go through what some of your patients have to go through, but I worry sometimes that the world is such a demanding place that it's easy for any of us to get caught on the current and carried off in different directions that are not perhaps beneficial to us or not adding the value we deserve and more explicitly get caught up in that goal-orientated approach. So,
fascinating question. Yes.
I suppose there's half a dozen questions in there.
Yes. I think in summary, I think it's a reaction of people to the diseases they go through. And yes, we, as you rightly said, we see so many different reactions. Many people come out stronger because they have gone through a phase of seeing mortality, and they suddenly realize that life is temporary and you have to live life. And so I've seen many patients who come out stronger, happier. And that is our aim as doctors. When I do a breast cancer operation, it is not just to cure breast cancer, but to, if possible, try and, you know, improve their results, the overall results. And that's what we are trained for. But you are absolutely right. There are many who struggle going forward, the worry of cancer coming back and the worry around it. So yes, it's so many fascinating aspects. And more fascinating is doctors who have gone through these diseases, doctors who have had cancer. It often, I mean, I haven't had to, but I've read about people and their outlook changes significantly, both their own and their reaction to the patient. So, yes, it's fascinating.
That would be an interesting conversation, as you say, for those on the other side who are the consultants or the surgeons that are performing it and then find themselves the other side of the desk, as it were. You know, a big part of psychology and psychotherapy and counseling is that to be able to truly empathize, we have to go through our own personal therapy, and not just for the purpose of exercise and just experience it, but to go through our own cathartic process, to enable us to offer accurate empathy. And so it would be a fascinating conversation to explore further. But we are always here on the Happiness Algorithm challenged by time itself. So we are coming to a close. But before we do, it's important for the listeners to understand how they can reach out and perhaps contact you in some way. Now, in the interest of transparency, we must declare that Harun, both you and I work at the same hospital, the Springfield Hospital in Chelmsford, who are the glorious sponsors of the Happiness Algorithm. And obviously, we work in the private sector in that respect, obviously, NHS position as well. Let's just, you know, touch on the work that you're doing at Springfield and the sort of differences between both private care and NHS public care.
Yes, so the majority of my work is in the NHS, probably 90% would be NHS work. As I said, it is in South and Mid Essex hospitals. And my private work is at Springfield Hospital. We try to maintain the same quality of care both in the NHS. So essentially what that means is if someone can pay, they shouldn't get a better outcome. But what probably differs is the experience. So you can travel from A to B in a car which costs a few hundred to a few millions. It will get you to the same destination most of the time, but the experience is different. And that's what we try to provide in a private hospital. It is more individualized care, more consultant delivered care, ensuite rooms and better facilities. So it's more one-to-one care, and it's the same consultant you see throughout. So that's the main advantage of private care. But having said that, NHS is such a valuable resource, giving such high quality care. I would, strongly tell anyone, don't borrow money to, have private care, because NHS is brilliant. But as we touched up before, money is to buy experiences. And so if someone has the money, private care does provide a better experience, but the aim is to take everyone to the same destination.
Wonderful distinction or clarification that actually the care itself or procedure doesn't change, the quality in that respect, the medicine itself doesn't change. And I think that's great to clear that up. Now, Harun, how can people, and I'm sure there will be many that are interested in sort of learning more or getting to know you a little bit more in respect of what you do, and perhaps you could share your website and so that they can, as I say, see more about you and perhaps reach out. So how would they be able to get in touch with you?
I've got a website. It is www.essexbreastsurgeon.com. It's a very basic website, which just gives an introduction to me and a way to contact me. I'm quite happy for people to contact me for, general chat and, to explore these concepts further. I have to admit I am learning in this process, and I'm no expert in these well-being concepts. Of course, I can't give any advice on breast cancer care as such on those platforms. I am not a big fan of social media. I am on something, but I'm not a big fan of social media purely because of the emotional harm that can cause into. So I try to avoid that as much as possible. But my website, www.essexbreastsurgeon.com, is the best way to get in touch with me.
Wonderful. And so the future, Harun, next 6, 12, 24 months, what do you hope for? What are you looking to experience on that ongoing journey?
Enjoy the journey as much as I can. Experiences are the spice of life, and that's what makes life fun. This radio show is a new experience for me, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Participate in new experiences like these. My idea is to further all these roles that I'm doing, try and look after as many breast cancer patients as possible. It's an absolute privilege to support these patients through their journey, teach others on other doctors. If I teach one doctor, it's helping so many more patients. I've got some research interests and explore those well-being concepts more and more, and participate and grow as I go forward.
Well said, well said. Enjoying the journey. Experiences are the spice of life, and I think we can all agree and take something from that without a doubt. Now, before we close the show, obviously we do have to hand over to our resident expert, which is Mr. Hanks, to see what he thought of the show. So, Tom, how do you think today's show went?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
I would absolutely agree with you. I would say that was a successful broadcast and a very, very enjoyable show. We are there. We've come to a close. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Harun Thomas. What an amazingly interesting conversation it has been today. I've taken so much from today's show. We will be back next week with another interesting, amazing guest with more incredible music. I have been James Roast. This has been the Happiness Algorithm, if I can say it. This has been the Happiness Algorithm. Be safe, be healthy, and be happy.
Daisies swaying, free in the breeze. The birds in the trees are singing along with me. I'm just looking for happy. Sunrise lights my smiley face clock. Sliding in my socks, I pour my first cup of tea. I'm just looking for happy. If you open your heart, you will see there's a million little opportunities. For happy
comfy chair, pages where wizards and knights have magical fights as the rain taps so tepidly. I'm just looking for happy. For happy, looking for happy.
toes in the sand, your head on my shoulder, drinking the moment the sun falls into the sea. I'm just looking for happy. Yeah, I'm just looking for happy.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
When it comes to healthcare, you want to feel safe and you don't want to wait for your treatment. That's why Springfield Hospital, conveniently located on the outskirts of Chelmsford, should be your local hospital of choice. Our private patient pledge covers every procedure, offering flexible appointments, price match, unlimited aftercare, 0% finance and fixed price packages to help make your healthcare affordable. Find us at springfieldhospital.co.uk. People caring for people. Part of the Ramsey Group.
Phoenix FM.